10 to 1, episode 187.
Books 2024.
Welcome to 10 to 1, the podcast where we make top 10 lists about everything. I'm Melissa Kozer.
And I'm Brian Kozer. I think the ratio of new books read last year to rereads, also about 10 to 1 for me.
So you had a lot more new books, is what you mean?
Yep.
Okay, yeah. No, I think I was the opposite.
About 5 rereads. Let's see. That I read 58 books last year, and 5 were rereads.
I read a bunch of books last year. 51 books, and 19 of them were new. So the bulk of mine were rereads.
Wow. That'll be my year this year, and we can maybe talk about that at the end. But let's see. So looking at my Goodreads, my year in books, the shortest book I read was 55 pages. Let me see. Is this on my... Yeah, this did not quite make my top 10 list, but I should mention this one. It's 55 pages. It's The Akbaritha, to which is appended The Songs of the Seven Cities by Richard Rowland, that I've mentioned a few times on the podcast. He is a Germanic philologist, which is the same thing that J.R.R. Tolkien was. And
what's a philologist?
Yeah, so they study language and story. And you could think of a linguist just kind of studying language as its own sealed off thing. But before linguists, it was philology, and it was story and language together, because those are inextricable. You can't study them separately, is what Tolkien would have said. So yeah, this guy's writing. He's been writing for most of his life now. He's been writing poems and stories in this fictional world, and this is the first, I think, the first thing he published of it. So that was neat. And longest book, we will get to that one at some point on my list. Average book, 325 pages. Most popular book I read was Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. And read that with the girls. That was the first time read. That was fun. And least shelved, again, The Akbaritha. Only 15 other people have shelved that on Goodreads. Highest rated on Goodreads, The Bible for Children by Walter Wangerin Jr., a children's adaptation I don't think you were particularly fond of, but it has a 5-star average because I think only a couple people have rated it. My first review of the year was...
It took liberties. And that's as the all nice adaptations way I'm going to put it. It took more liberties than I was fine with. It took dumb liberties. Anyway.
And that's where I will... That's where I'll stop my little Goodreads thing.
Okay.
You'll be able to check us out on Goodreads. We'll put links to that in the show notes.
Hey, what if they want to hear mine?
Oh, do you have yours open?
Yeah.
Oh, go for it.
Yeah. I read 17,700 pages.
Ooh, 19,000 for me.
And 51 books.
Yeah.
My shortest book was Possum Magic, 32 pages.
Hmm.
And the longest was The Iliad, 848. My average book length was 347 pages. Most shelved, most people read it, is The Secret Garden.
Hmm.
Least read is Caring for Your Own Dead.
Oh, yes. I wonder why no one's
Nobody wants to take care of their dead relatives.
Pick that up.
Just shove them in the ground and mail me a card saying you've done it. The highest rated is In Vital Harmony.
Ah, yeah. I read that one.
The first book I read of the year was Villains by Necessity.
Ah, yes. Definitely got your rereads.
Yeah.
Your favorite rereads starting off.
Started off with beginning. Some candy.
All right. Well, why don't we just jump into the list? So it's my turn to go first. So I will tell you that my number 10 from last year, if I can get my list back, I'm going to put, let's see, is this the only nonfiction? No, because I have a collection of, no, I have a couple. I have 3 nonfiction on this list.
Oh, I actually had 20 books that I read this year. Ooh, oh, snap. I missed that one.
Ooh. All right.
I'm going to have to rethink my list.
All right, redo your list. You don't have to redo the whole thing. You just have to put one.
Everything changes.
One into that list somewhere. Find out where that one goes. And number 10 is an honorable mention. Okay, so this is not my only nonfiction. But this is the history book on my list. And it is Dominion, How the Christian Revolution Remade the World. And have I mentioned this on the podcast or just when you and I have been talking? I
don't recall you mentioning it even to me.
Well, I'd mentioned it just 1 or 2 days ago because we saw a YouTube thumbnail that said, "Don't Tom Holland pill me."
Oh, okay.
And I had to explain what that meant, and it involved the Matrix, and it involved the historian, pop historian Tom Holland, who wrote this book, Dominion, which is basically Christianity is so foundational to Western civilization that it's like the fish swimming in the water that don't even know what water is. It's just something that completely surrounds you. And he makes a good case for it, and it's good pop history. I don't have enough time, I think, to do super detailed scientific type histories. I also just think it's less interesting than someone putting history into a narrative. Obviously, you're going to get people leaving things out when they do that, but that's going to happen anyway, unless you have just like a scientific report of some, and nobody wants to read that. So give me the pop history, as long as it's by, someone that's not a politician, nice. Yeah. Or a YouTuber, or, as long as it's somebody that's actually
competent.
Your Dan Carlin types, Tom Hollands, your pop historians. Give me those. So I do recommend Dominion by Tom Holland. If you're a fan of podcasts, which you might be, he has a podcast called The Rest is History. It's just everything in history. Him and another guy, Dominic. And those are good fun.
How long are the episodes?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay. I really liked the Way I Heard It by Mike Rowe for a while.
They're longer than that.
But then he started going off script and just doing things. He kind of, like all podcasters do, eventually just, did his own thing. Didn't stick to a time constraint. And I just like the little vignettes. So.
Yeah, these are like an hour or less. But many of them will go up to an hour.
Yeah.
And then be in multiple parts.
Okay.
But I mean, they've maybe done someday. Things. Yeah. I mean, just everything. Like, here's a few of their recent episodes. Death in the Amazon, Aguirre, the Wrath of God.
Oh.
Yeah.
I like that movie.
History there. About searching for El Dorado. Elizabeth the First's Sorcerer, Angels and Demons in Renaissance Europe.
Okay, I might have to check this out.
I'm definitely going to have to listen to that because I was just reading some weird stuff. So this is about John Dee. Have you heard of John Dee?
No.
D-E-E. I mean, I'd heard the name, but this guy was so interesting. I mean, like we think of Isaac Newton, and Isaac Newton, of course, is, a mathematician, a scientist. You probably don't think that he was also an alchemist and also had some interesting interesting spiritual things that he was getting into.
No, you don't think of that, do you?
No, you don't. But that seems very common. And John Dee is maybe like the other side of the coin, where he was a mathematician, he was an astronomer, also he was getting visions from archangels. He believed that King Arthur had sent an expedition to the New World, and that there were survivors, and he was then instrumental in sending ships during the Age of Discovery, like encouraging England to send ships. He knew a lot about optics and navigation. He knew all these people, so he was talking to like Queen Elizabeth's spy master and all these people from the continent, and the guy that invented the Atlas. And so he tried to pitch a national library, and the queen said no. So he decided to build his own personal library, which ended up being larger than the libraries at Cambridge and Oxford combined.
Goals.
And so the queen was visiting his library.
I love it.
Yeah, so, I mean, just a really, really interesting guy. Sad ending. Loses everything.
Aw.
Yeah, maybe don't go summoning demons. Because I think maybe where it ended up going. But
wow.
Anyway, the rest is history.
Okay, I'll have to check out that podcast.
Lots of interesting stuff. And check out Dominion if you want a very brief, I mean, it's 700 pages, but we're talking about 2,000 years of history. Starting from AD, or from a few years BC, I think it might start with Julius Caesar, and then go forward to 2020, I believe.
Wow.
In a few hundred pages. So, yes. Yep. Recommend Dominion by Tom Holland.
Wow.
Anyway, I will.
I mean, I don't know how you
do this podcast.
All that in one book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the way he does it is, so let's say if there's 20 centuries, there's maybe about 20 chapters, and for each century about, he's got an interesting figure, and he'll kind of talk about that one person in some amount of detail. So maybe get 10 pages on that person, and then kind of broadly a little bit like what's happening around
Europe.
Get an
eagle's eye of the... Yeah. Okay. So. Maybe I'll check that out then, because my history and my scope of history is pretty garbage.
I think you'd enjoy this one. This would be a good one to start with.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So that's your 10?
That's my 10, and I will keep it moving a lot better.
All right.
For the next 9.
Well, speaking of garbage, my number 10 is The Year of No Garbage by Eve Schaub, S-E-H-A-U-B. Boy, what an interesting book. This is, I don't do this often. I was in Barnes & Noble, and I saw this on the shelf and just had to buy it. And I was so rewarded. It was worth the money. This lady got the crazy idea of, instead of throwing things away, she wanted to reduce, reuse, recycle for a whole year. And so she got her family on board with it. And then they implemented it in the year 2020. So she quickly found out that I really encourage you to go read the book. But the basic gist of it is the system is not the way things are set up. It actually prohibits recycling. Mm-hmm. It's very expensive and time consuming if you are actively trying to recycle and do a good job and save the planet. And then it turns out that a lot of companies are just straight up lying about recycling. They're not doing it. They're just taking it and dumping it somewhere. But hey, they look good. And even your local city might not, you know, actually be recycling what they say they're recycling. And then the biggest thing is that plastic can't be recycled. For the most part, there's some plastic can be recycled, but and she goes into great detail about this, but in a non like confusing way for us plebeians. She talks about how plastic is pretty toxic. It's not good for our health. It breaks apart. It's constantly shedding, and it causes all sorts of. It can accumulate in the body and cause health problems. And when you recycle it, you make it much less stable, to where it is a lot more toxic. And the thing about plastic is that it absorbs other things, and then at the same time releases those things that it's holding on to into as it breaks down, as it sheds, it releases those little particles all, everywhere too. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so most plastic can't be recycled, and we're all just going to die under a mountain of plastic is kind of where I was at when I was reading this. I was like, oh my word. Our kids, what are we doing to them and our grandkids? But she does end on a note of hope and with some actionable steps that if we all start doing something that is better than just being like, we can't do anything. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest things you can do is start pressing your politicians to pass laws to require that manufacturers be responsible for what is done with the packaging that they sell. And then if they become responsible for it, then they're going to start changing. Well, the thought is that they would start changing what kind of packaging they use to make it a lot more earth friendly. Mm-hmm. I don't know that more legislation is the answer. But I mean, it might be. Who knows? But it's definitely
makes you feel any better. I doubt you can convince your politician to.
Yeah.
they
did
it asking nicely.
They did it in California and in New York, which okay. I'm not going to say are paragons of
did it work
the way I think. But in New York, they got plastic bags banned.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but wait, what do we put the cat poop in if we don't have plastic bags?
You throw it in your compost.
Hmm.
I think it was like at the grocery store, they got plastic bags banned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so you had to go, you had to take your reusable bags.
Mm-hmm.
Always.
Sure.
So, I think like that alone would be a really good step.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it'll make you think, but it's funny too. It's not a preachy book,
mm-hmm.
Which is what it could so easily turn into.
Yeah.
It's very much, she's like, she sees how like she became an absolute nutcase about this, and she fully mm-hmm. owns it. And she's like, I'm so thankful that my family loved me through it. So anyway, really good book. Highly recommend Year of No Garbage.
Yeah, sounds like we got what we needed from you for that one.
Aww.
All right. Number 9 is 1984 by George Orwell, a book that every American in 2025 should read. Well, maybe not if you're 5 or 6 years old, or 7 or 8. But somebody that's living in our time at some point needs to be handed 1984. And it might be when they say something like, the definitions of words don't matter, or...
Just trust the government.
Sure.
I'm sure they know what they're doing. If they recommend it, it's safe. They wouldn't roll it out if it wasn't safe.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, the changing history, constant warfare, constant surveillance. Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot there. I get that it's not fun to read, but I don't think it's supposed to be fun to read. I think Orwell was too good a writer to accidentally write a book that's not fun. I think that's part of the point. So, if you haven't read it, like I had not until this past year, I think that's one to put on the to get to eventually list. 1984.
That is a book.
Yep. You can't deny anything I've said about it.
Why would I?
That's right.
My number 9 is a book by a comedian, and I recommend that you listen to it on audiobook, have him relating his own stories. It's James Acaster's Classic Scrapes. Fun. Boy, is this so funny.
Funny guy.
So we encountered James Acaster on the TV show Taskmaster and also on What I Lied to You. And he's quite the character.
Mm-hmm.
And some of his stories from What I Lied to You are in this book, and others are not. Some that were not on the show are in the book.
Yeah.
And like, you'll just be like, what kind of a human being? Is this a human being? I can't. He's an interesting character.
Hmm.
He's got a story about him, how he ended up sleeping in a bush, dressed in a red dress, at a train station, and there's some others that are just it's worth listening to. That's my number 9, James Acaster's Classic Scrapes.
Yeah, I want to get to that one eventually. Would you say that? If we had to erase one book from existence, 1984 or James Acaster's Classic Scrapes, which book would you erase?
James Acaster.
Okay. I just wondered.
Just because I don't like the book doesn't mean. Are you done picking on me?
It's good radio. All right. That's all I wanted. On to number 8 for me. And I think of the books I read last year, I think this is the one I would most recommend to you. Either this one or the next one, but maybe this one. It's called Jaber Crow by Wendell Berry. And I know you're a Wendell Berry nonfiction fan. I think it's time for you to become a Wendell Berry fiction fan.
What was the nonfiction of his that I read?
I'm not sure that you've read any directly.
I think I've just seen him referenced by
He's certainly, circles. Yeah, he's certainly upstream from a lot of the homesteading and crunchy stuff that you're into. So I think he's the intersection point between...
He's your bridge that you can
literature, the literature and the homesteading, So it's about a barber in a small town, and there are some very funny parts and there's some very sad parts, and I think you would really like this book. I won't even really try and explain it more than that. But I think I would hand this book to just about anybody. That's my number 8.
Okay.
Jaber Crow, maybe I'll say one more sentence about it. There's sort of a sadness about the things we've lost as communities and small towns have and small local farms have become bigger and more interconnected and more industrialized. So that's there's not like a solution or anything like that in here, but maybe a little bit of a lament for the things that we've lost there. So I think you'd like it. That's my number eight. What's yours?
My number eight is a book that you gave me for my birthday, I think.
Oh.
Perhaps, or later in the year. It's 84 Charing Cross Road by Helene Hont.
Oh, I'm so glad you like this.
Oh, it's so darling.
So this was a pick by the co-op moms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that's why I got it for you.
Yeah. And it's real short. I really recommend it. It's just a series of letters that this lady wrote from America to a bookshop in England during World War II, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a bit of a slice of life from that time. And it, at first it's just, I've heard that you have this book. Would you send it to me? We don't have it in stock right now, but we can order it. Oh, here is the book now. And then, like, it just starts really developing into a friendship because the American lady's a real character. And then just she's got a real fiery disposition, but also a big heart. And like, they start sending each other gifts. And it's not just about business transactions.
Mm.
And you get a broader sense of these people's lives just from their letters. I've heard there's a second book of her finally going over to visit everybody in England. So
The Duchess of Bloomsbury Street.
Yeah, I want to read that one. Heidi was saying that one's really good. She was laughing so hard through it all.
No.
Yeah.
All right.
It moved me in several places to some laughs, but also tears as well. So I think this one's for everybody. My number 84 Charing Cross.
Well, it's definitely on my list.
It's real short,
too. Yeah. All right. On to number 7. This is the other one I maybe would hand to you, along with Jaber Crow. Because I don't think you've read this one yet. It's Till We Have Faces, A Myth Retold by C.S. Lewis. It's maybe the best fiction he wrote. Maybe better than Narnia. Maybe better than the Space Trilogy. Maybe better than... what else? Screwtape Letters.
All right.
And, yeah, I mean, it's a retelling of Cupid and Psyche. But
I love that story.
Right. It's a great story. But then he just puts so many layers on it. Like it's definitely his most mature fiction, not in the sense of like mature content, but in the sense of maybe most serious in a way, most heartfelt, maybe in a way, most, most layers. And I do wish he had been able to write a few more, a few more at the end of his life, at this depth. Because I like, you know, always gonna really like Narnia, and the Space Trilogy, so I'm not saying this is my favorite that he wrote, but maybe his best. And definitely one I'm going to have to reread, I think, to really, really completely understand it. I pretty much always will write a review on Goodreads, even if it's just a sentence. And I remember I just kind of sat there with the text box. And I think I tried to type out a few things and erase them and ended up not posting anything because I didn't quite know what to say. So maybe one that's going to have to germinate inside me more before I can really talk about it. So that's Till We Have Faces.
Okay.
A myth retold.
My number 7 is from Terry Pratchett. I did a bunch of Pratchett reading last year. I had intended to get through all of the death books. Mm. I didn't.
Well, that's quite a few, right? There's like 6 or 7 of those.
Right. I did all of the Watch books last year, I think.
Okay.
Or the previous year, 2023. And then I was trying to get through all the death ones. I got through a bunch. I think I got stopped at... I didn't do Hogfather, and then there's another one. But I did get to Thief of Time, which is one that I hadn't gotten to. That one was good. But then the series that I did get to all of them this past year was the Witches books. And my number 7 is Lords and Ladies. And mm-hmm. this one, Granny Weatherwax, is just so cool. Of course, it's all mostly the story of developing Granny. But Nanny Ogg's in there too, and mm-hmm. she's a lot of fun. You've got Margaret Garlick as well, as she's going from wet hen, basically, to wet hen witch to the Queen of Lancre. And sort of getting her stride there. And then you have the Fae folk come back. Mm. And everyone's under their spell. Except the witches. They can see them for what they are. And so you have Granny like just doing some super cool stuff. Like gets shot with an arrow. And yet manages to hike up an injured person over her shoulder and run away from the Fae folk. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's such a cool character. and things like that. And then also, it's really fun because you have Rig Coley, the Arch Chancellor, in here. And it turns out he and Granny used to be sweethearts. Mm-hmm. And so it explores that a little bit. And of course, like, they're two such very indomitable personalities that seeing them go against each other is just really fun.
Yeah.
So I don't remember what all Pratchett was exploring. Usually he's got some like something he's exploring on a deeper level. I don't remember what he was exploring with this one, but it was fun.
Yeah, I read that one last year too for the first time, and it's like I looked at my ranking. That one's probably like a top 5 Discworld for me at this point, having read 25 of them. And that is a good one. Something deeper. I mean, it's a lot of the kind of fairies, not like Tinkerbell kind of fairy, but like more
Elven.
And not like Tolkien elves, nope. But like the scary,
yeah, you don't want these
folk
around.
Story,
yeah,
fairies. A lot of that kind of works into the story, I think. Yeah. That is a good one. All right. Good pick. On to my number 6. I think we're on 6. And this is another nonfiction. And I was slowly reading through these last year. And it's In Defense of Sanity, The Best Essays of G.K. Chesterton. And there were several that I think there's a few that I read the entire essay to you. But it certainly would often turn to you and read a favorite line because
he's got such a way with words.
He's the king of the aphorism, the quip, the paradox. And great wordsmith. I will have to put I still have not added my favorite. I think I wrote down a list of my favorite essays from him somewhere. I'll have to add that to my Goodreads because I think, unless you are a really big fan of his, or you're like a completionist that has to read the whole thing, I think it's fine if you, you know, read a half dozen, and you could certainly get a good taste of who he is. And so, if you're interested, I think you can find all of his online at this point. His are 110 or more years old, I think, at this point, his writings. So public domain. And he's definitely worth reading. And, it's essays. It's a few pages. So you should check out his writings. Great literary thoughts. He wrote on Charles Dickens. And he wrote on Shakespeare a lot. He wrote just kind of fun stories like some that I really like are him writing. He's at the train station and he has nothing to do. He forgot to bring a book or anything to do, so he's just pulling things out of his pockets and he's writing an essay on the things he found in his pockets.
That's so great.
Yeah. Or
boy, if I were to write an essay about the things I find in my pockets, like I'm constantly picking up little things from around the house. And then at the end of the day, I'm like, what is all this?
Yep. So, I'm a big G.K. Chesterton fan. I'm just doing rereads this year, but I am rereading still some of his essays that I'd read a couple years ago. So, and I actually just realized I went out of order. This is actually my number 5, but I'll let you do your next one. Okay. And then I'll tell you what my actual 6 is.
Okay. My number 6 is another Pratchett, and it's another in the Witch series. And it's the last one, actually. It's Carpe Jugulum. Hmm. Jugulum.
Okay, I haven't read this one yet.
Yeah, it's so good. So the story is that vampires enter Lanker and take over. And it's a story of ultimately how Granny manages to defeat them.
Mm-hmm.
But it has a lot of threads that Pratchett, I felt, mostly tied together. There were a couple I felt were not as neatly tied with the bow as I would have wanted. But this is the book where I realized that Granny Weatherwax is actually Terry Pratchett. And it really discusses belief, mm-hmm. Especially in a higher power, and religion. And it's very, very thought-provoking.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot to think about and consider. But the story itself is also just really good. Just he takes the whole vampires, you know, these are the monsters that come in the night and they're blood-sucking. And he turns that up on its head to, no, the monsters have been invited in and they're just going to quietly take control, and if you just submit yourself to them and come when they call and let them have some of your blood, they won't bring you all away, they won't kill you, and then you can go back on, you know, back to your normal lives, and we'll even make it part of a coming of age thing that you're old enough now to be able to participate in this ritual, and you can even get a sort of a badge, you know, of I got your first blood drawn or whatever. And it's monstrous in its own way. And then at the end, it ends up the people actually prefer the monster in the dark that snatches you and stuff like that. So it's very well done. My number six, Carpe Jugulum.
Yeah, it definitely seems like a good character is a part of, like, enough of a piece of the author that they can kind of live on their own. Maybe would be how I would put it. And you can definitely see parts of him in a part of him as Granny Weatherwax, and a part of him as Rid Coley, and a part of him as
Sam Vimes.
Yeah, maybe Vimes.
I would
maybe.
I would pick more for Vetinari, maybe.
I think. Yeah, I don't know that.
He writes Vimes so well, though.
Yeah, yeah, he does. He does. Now, I think maybe more Rincewind was maybe. But, yeah, that's great. I kind of don't want to read to the end of that series, just because it is sad that it'll be sad to finish. But I'll keep slowly going through those.
Well, as long as a man's name is spoken, he's never truly dead.
That's true. Good point. All right. So my number five is In Defense of Sanity, the Best Essays of G.K. Chesterton. But my number six is The Brothers Karamazov, which...
Oh, that's on my to-read list.
I was not planning to read last year. And then The House of Humane Letters offered a class from Dr. Jason Baxter, where he went through the book and also kind of talked about especially Father Zosima, the priest character in the book, and talked about things like non-places, how things like airports and malls and some of these places that we've architected are not places to live. They're like places to pass through, and how that affects us, and how what that means for us. So some really, really interesting thoughts. Book itself, of course, very good. I didn't realize it's another one of these kind of incomplete things where it seems like Dostoevsky was going to write a sequel. There's definitely some plot threads that don't get wrapped up that probably would have got addressed in a sequel, you'd imagine. And yeah, but I'm a fan of really long, messy, imperfect novels. And this was a fun one to read through very quickly. This is pretty much all I read for a month. And yeah. A slower reread at some point. The Brothers Karamazov. My number six. So we're to your number five now, should be.
Yeah. All right. My number five is The Enchanted Castle by E. Nesbitt.
Okay.
I'm trying to find it. Where is it?
I'm aware of this book. It's on our shelf. I'm aware of E. Nesbitt, but I don't think I've read any of her works. Had you read anything of her before this?
Did she also write The Secret Garden?
Nope.
No, okay. Seemed like I read something else by her, maybe not. But this is a really good book. It kind of felt sort of Narnia-esque. Hmm. You have children who they're kind of stuck together. They're not able to go home for the holidays, and they're kind of at this boarding house. Hmm. And then they go out for a walk one day, and they come across this castle. Like, they just go exploring, and it's this beautiful castle grounds with all these gardens and walkways and avenues with statues in them and secret fountains and things like that. Hmm. and they climb into the, but it's all like very quiet and nobody's around, and they go into the castle itself. Okay. And that too is also empty, and there's a hidden room in there, and then they find all these jewels in there, and there's this ring that actually has the magic. It's a magic ring, and it does different things. Uh-huh. And like, it's got this very sort of ethereal, like, what is real, what is not. And just every time that you think you've got this book pegged down as, oh yeah, I know, you know, the children are just playing pretend. No, actually they're not. Okay, well, this is sort of, it's got a dreamlike feel to it, but like, there's real actual consequences that are happening too. And it's so, so good. And maybe there's, you know, things happening on a deeper level. I definitely want to go back and reread it. I like how, as the different issues crop up, and they all naturally happen, the children find very natural childish solutions that still work, but without being like stretching belief too. And it's really good. The ending I did not understand. I felt like it really got really big and got away from me. So That's partly why I want to go back and reread it. But I think there's more there that I didn't quite grasp. But it's really good. I think you will really enjoy it.
Okay. All right. Maybe one to read to the girls at some point then.
Yeah.
You mentioned Lewis. I'm pretty sure C.S. Lewis mentioned her as someone he enjoyed reading and as an influence on his fiction writing. It possibly Tolkien said that. Possibly both. I think C.S. Lewis. So.
By the way, is it Tolkien or Tolkien?
Tolkien, actually.
Oh.
Yep. But I think Americans, we generally say Tolkien. Just don't say that to his face. My number four, and this is my favorite nonfiction of the year. Man, maybe this should be higher. An Experiment in Criticism, C.S. Lewis. So I think Till We Have Faces is probably his best fiction. An Experiment in Criticism is his best nonfiction. I think without a doubt, it's him writing about literary criticism. It's very lucidly written. Sometimes you get his nonfiction and he's writing for an audience of professors or college students at Oxford, or, you know, it's a lecture that he gave and then kind of transcribed into a book. And so for something like The Discarded Image, which I liked a lot, but it's hard to kind of get into it because he's not writing to like a popular audience. But this one, I thought, very clearly written. So I thought he wrote it very well. And then, I mean, the subject is very interesting. If you're listening to us talk about books, like, this is him talking about how do you talk about books and making a case for like literature. Like, you can look at a book of literature and you can look at a nonfiction book, and because they both look physically the same, you think you would read them the same and understand them the same way. But he makes the case that a book of literature is actually closer to something like a symphony, and so there's a very different way that you read it and understand it. And so the other things that we've talked about of the way that you should surrender yourself to great art instead of kind of putting yourself above it and looking down on it. You look at it as an object and you try to be humble when you go to it. That's something that he talks about here. I will Oh, you can go read my review. This is one I did write more about on Goodreads. But I'll just end with how he ends the book. Because it's one of my favorite things that he wrote. But in reading great literature, I become a thousand men and yet remain myself. Like the night sky in the Greek poem, I see with a myriad eyes, but it is still I who see. Here, as in worship, in love, in moral action, and in knowing, I transcend myself, and am never more myself than when I do. Which is a great capstone on a great book. So, if you like talking about books, or you like listening to people talk about books, this is absolutely one to check out. And again, a very short one. I think it's like 120 pages. As far as C.S. Lewis nonfiction goes, like as easy to read as something like Mere Christianity. So, highly recommend An Experiment in Criticism. My number four.
All right, my number four is my last Terry Pratchett on this list. It's Masquerade, Masquerade.
Why did you have to do it, Terry? Sir Terry?
Yeah. So this one, of course, just fully embraces that it is Phantom of the Opera. Like, there is... it is that whole plot.
Yeah.
Only we have Nanny Ogg and Granny Weatherwax. Okay. So the backstory is Nanny Ogg wrote a cookbook.
Okay. I'm not seeing how this is going to lead
to. Sent it off to Ankh-Morpork. But she wrote it in her usual way, which is with a lot of dirty jokes.
Yeah.
And it's basically a how-to book. And not just for cooking.
Yes.
And, but she put it under Granny's name.
Okay.
And so it actually sells really, really well. And yes. So Granny is like, well, we're going to go get that money. You are being shortchanged.
Okay, still and not she seeing puts it Phantom under, of the Opera here.
She puts it under, you know, I'm concerned for you, Nanny, but it's very much the fact that, well, this is under my name, so this is where I'm going to get the money that's coming. And the whole book is so, so fun. It's Nanny and Granny just going back and forth at each other. And at one point, they have to look the part. I forget exactly how they end up going over to the theater. But they end up discovering that there's something afoot there, and they better investigate. And to get in, they decide to act like they're patrons and very wealthy patrons.
Mm.
And so Granny's like, Nanny, you can't dress up. You're common as muck.
Mm-hmm.
And Nanny's like, fair enough. I do look common as muck. But then she tries to get the edge on Granny by using some stuff from her cookbook to make the night pretty spicy. And it's such a funny book. It's possibly one of the funniest Discworld books I've ever read.
Wow.
Such a treat. And Nanny really shines in this one. She's always playing second fiddle to Granny. She still does. Granny's still cooler, but Nanny she's cool in her own way. And like, I forgot to mention, she has a really fun moment too in Lords and Ladies, where like she has her own style of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Granny's all about the headology and kind of outsmarting the other side. And Nanny is just about sensibly...
Headology is what she calls psychology.
Yeah,
in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Since Nanny outsmarts the other side too, but it's in a very different way than Granny does it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, just the two of them and the way they come at things, it's delightful. And having read Phantom of the Opera, so I watched the movie first, loved it, read the book and thought this is not very good, not that great, and maybe I missed something, but I'm good without ever reading it again. But if I ever, anytime I need a Phantom of the Opera book, this is it. Masquerade by Terry Pratchett. Good All enough right. for me.
Guess I'll get there eventually.
Yeah.
Okay, my number three is the longest book that I read last year. This is that 1,100 page, maybe. Giant book that took me 9 months, 8 months to read last year, Infinite Jest. And can't recommend it for you. Or to most people. Very long. I mean, there's several hundred pages before where I just thought, this is fine. And I don't know exactly when it clicked, but it was probably, you know, 700 pages.
Oh my word.
When it finally went from this is fine to wow, this is actually really good. So I don't know exactly how he does it, but he apparently was very meticulous, and I don't know how you meticulously write a book over 1,000 pages long, but somehow somehow he did it. There's all sorts of very weird things, so it's like near future America, all of the years aren't just numbers anymore, now the years have sponsors, so there's the year of the Purdue Wonder Chicken, or the year of Glad, because the company that makes the trash bags paid the government to get their name as the name for the year.
Wow, I can actually really see that.
I know.
That's so...
Yeah.
Unsettling.
Yes, yes. The infinite jest of the title is a movie made by a guy that's really bad at making movies. He just makes like artsy movies, and then it seems like, and you're never exact. This is one where it's just everything's disjointed. Things are told from different characters' perspectives, and you have to kind of piece things together. And there's people that, when this was written before, like as the internet was in its infancy,
I don't think I would like this book.
People were going on and theorizing about what things meant, and. The beginning has things that tie into the end, and so it's kind of like a loop. But anyway, it seems like one of the characters that's dead by the time the book starts was this artsy filmmaker that got criticized for just making really boring artistic films, and then decided he was just going to make something very entertaining and crowd pleasing, and it was so successful that anyone that sees it instantly like shuts down into like a vegetative state, and it's impossible for them to escape. They just want to keep rewatching it over and over and over. And so then like the first time that this tape shows up in the book, like a guy's watching it, and then his wife comes in and she's starts watching it, so then she's trapped, and then like the neighbors come in, now they're trapped, and the police get called in, now they're trapped. I don't know, there's like giant mutant hamsters because the northeastern United States is now a dumping ground for our trash. We just like catapult our trash into where Maine used to be, and now Canada's angry at us because we're just dumping all of our trash on the border. And I mean, I don't know. I don't know. It's weird and often boring. And I don't know. I thought there was a chance I would hate it, and then I thought I was just going to be okay with it, and then ended up thinking it was pretty great. So let me leave you with a quote from David Foster Wallace. In dark times, the definition of good art would seem to be art that locates and applies CPR to those elements of what's human and magical that still live and glow despite the time's darkness. Really good fiction could have as dark a worldview as it wished, but it'd find a way both to depict this world and to illuminate the possibilities for being alive and human in it. And mission accomplished. Mr. Foster Wallace. Actually, I think his middle name was Foster. That's Infinite Jest.
Okay.
Skip it. I say to you, Melissa, you listener.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know from listening to that if that's a possibility for you or not.
So you might have thought
top three. Here we go.
My list is pretty much just fluff and nonsense compared to Brian's.
No.
But I did get a little bit of culture last year. I read the Iliad for the first time. That's my number three.
That was your first time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
I'm still happy about that.
Got the story of the Greeks attacking Troy, not them conquering it. Still. Well, we got to that part in the Aeneid so far. But
yeah, the story of good. The rage of Achilles.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was so surprised by how gory it is. Mm. You get not just chopping off heads, but like everything happening. But it's so good. And it really surprised me how much I enjoyed this book. I think if I had to rate them so far, probably I would rank the Odyssey first.
Yeah.
And then the Iliad. And so far the Aeneid is just not as good as the Iliad. I am struggling to get on Team Troy over Team Greece.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Yeah, you definitely have to make that switch.
Sorry, the writing's just not as good, Virgil. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that is in translation. I think reading it in Latin might be more important for the Aeneid than reading in Greek is for Homer. I've read something along those lines. I can't read either Greek or Latin, so I can't say for sure, but it seems like the style and the mood in the Latin is part of what really made the Aeneid special.
We read the book last year and then listened to the Sci-Fi Christians doing their deep dive on it.
Very good.
Yearly shout out to them.
Yep.
And it was really good. Highly recommend you go listen to it. One of the parts that surprised me the most about this book, it actually really moved me, is towards the end. Spoiler alert, but it's okay. This is a really old book.
BC.
You have Hector is kind of the champion for Troy, and he ends up getting killed by Achilles, and Achilles has his body, and Hector's father Priam goes secretly to Achilles in the dead of night to beg for his son's body back so that they can bury it with full honors. And just the interaction at that point between them is so moving. It's so well written. I felt that the whole book is leading up to that moment, and it's such a good moment. It's so worth it. And it doesn't feel like it was a slog to get there. Don't get that idea, but it is just a perfect cap to the story. My number three, the Iliad.
Ah, that's a good pick. I don't know that I can say many of the books on my list are better than the Iliad. I'm up to number two, and it's The Pickwick Papers by Charles Dickens, my favorite Charles Dickens. And it's, again, very long, imperfect, rambling. It's, I was thinking about this. This is sort of like if instead of having to go throw the ring into Mount Doom, Frodo and Sam and Merry and Pippin rambled around London and the English countryside having very low stakes adventures. This is kind of like what that is.
And they got into Farmer Maggot's field a couple times.
Exactly. Chesterton, writing about this book, he has a really good essay on it. He made the point that this is sort of like the unformed and the watery chaos at the beginning of Dickens' career, where this is the first thing he wrote, and you can see like echoes of all of his books all contained here. So there's like a chapter where they all it's Christmas, and so they're returning to this friend's home, and they're rambling through the snow, and they're feasting, and they tell a ghost story, and so there's orphans, and there's funny servants, and there's rich widows, and a romance, and mistaken identity, and scrapes that they have to get in and out of, cheeky villains. It takes a little bit, I think, to get into, and I wonder how much of that is just in a long book. It takes you a little while to kind of kind of get going with the author, and how much of it was as he started to go along, he improved the story that he was telling. Because this is one he was kind of doing as like a writer for hire, I think, at first. It was supposed to be like they wanted him to write a story about like a sporting club, maybe like a hunting club. And then he ended up going in a different direction. He like adds characters as he goes, and this is a favorite book. This was good. The Pickwick Papers by Charles Dickens.
Okay. My last two are by the same author. The first one is King Arthur and His Knights of the Round Table by Roger Lansling Green.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say it's objectively better than the Iliad, but it was a fun read, and I had not read a full-on like narrative of King Arthur and his adventures and stuff, and so this was a really good introduction. It's accessible to all ages. It gets the general canon very nicely together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very cohesive. But it's really good. It's got the Christian element. It's got the supernatural elements there. It just takes the myths and makes them attainable.
Yeah.
And makes you sort of long for the ideals. Helps you understand why this is such a cherished part of British history and mythology.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, they say it's harder to write about virtue and goodness than to write about
vice.
Yeah. But yeah, Green pulls it off. Read this one to the girls last year. Very good. I agree. Good pick. Any other thoughts?
No.
All right. Well, we'll be back for a part two with Mr. Green after my number one. And it's The Silmarillion. And, you know.
One of these days I'll get around to reading that. Yeah. I got partway through and just couldn't make it.
Same. First time I read it, it was, I think it was during, it was in college. So it was a while ago. And didn't get through it. And, this time I found it much, I did not think it was difficult to read at all. So I think after reading things like, Homer and reading the Aeneid, I think you'll find this is, I mean, it's written by a modern author. I think you'll find this much more readable in comparison with some of the other things that you've read now since then. And so I mentioned at the very beginning reading Richard Roland's Ocborytha, where he tried to do, he's kind of like doing his own project, similar to what Tolkien did, writing myths and like a whole world sort of. And the highest compliment that I can pay to it is I read it, I enjoyed it, and I said, I have to go read the Silmarillion now. Because, you know, because that's the master's version. And did not disappoint. Not sure why I never got around to reading it until now, but
maybe because it's very long.
It is. And it is.
Covers like a crazy amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as long as the last couple books on my list. But
you read those, you can read anything.
That's right. It's just amazing. Someone, I don't remember who observed it, but that we have things like the King Arthur stories, and it's legends upon legends upon legends, and it starts with maybe a warlord in Britain after the Romans left. Possibly there's a historical Arthur there, and then there's stories that are told by the Welsh, and then there's stories told by the French, and then it comes back across the channel, and there's stories in Italy, and everyone in Europe is telling Arthur stories. And every generation kind of adds their own telling of the tale. And so you've got something like Arthur, or you've got you've got different folk tales that spring up in different countries, and myths. So think of like the Greek myths and all the authors together that told all these Greek myths. And it's like Tolkien was like a one man telling all the myths and tales, like a nation's worth of tales.
He's pretty incredible.
And inventing the languages. And again, because as a philologist, he said that you can't separate story and language, that they have to go together. And so, yeah, I mean, it's
incredible. Anytime I hear about all that Tolkien did, yeah, it's just like, and what am I doing with my life, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So that's my number one.
All right. I'll get to it someday.
Yeah.
Well, my number one is the other Roger Lanceland Green book that I read last year. And this one is about Robin Hood,
yeah,
the Adventures of Robin Hood. And again, I was very loosely familiar with, you know, he's an archer who went up against the Sheriff of Nottingham and Prince John. But I hadn't ever gotten a full rendering of the mythology of Robin Hood and his storyline, and where did he come from, and what did he really stand for and embody, you know? And I knew it was kind of like standing for the little guy against the oppressive regime, the overreaching government and stuff. But it was it's so good, and I liked it even better than than King Arthur. Like, that one is ancient history, but Robin Hood feels like the today, the common man,
It's an upside down world where the king is evil, and so the hero is the
outlaw. Yeah. I just love it, and it made me cry at the end when as he's dying, he tells Little John, "Help me hold my bow so I can shoot an arrow one more time, and where the arrow lands, that's where I want you to bury me."
Yeah.
And like he and Marion are, it's so sad, so tragic. But like the love and loyalty of his people, his friends and his merry men, and then even most of the surrounding people, you know, their loyalty, they recognize that Robin's good and on their side and he's doing what's right. And then it, like, it just makes it all the better when you've got some terrible traitor and finally Robin gives the, you know, the guy that betrayed him has come up and says, like, yes, you deserved that, buddy. And every time that the Sheriff of Nottingham gets spanked and Guy of Gisborne as well, it's just, it's so satisfying. So, really, really enjoyed this book. Definitely looking forward to rereading both of those. I don't want to ever get rid of those books. Lancelin Green has such a gift for taking these very old tales and making them so readable and so alive. And making you want that for our day and age. We need another Robin Hood, another King Arthur, to rally us all to want to not to do better. Yeah. Anyway. My number one.
All right. Well, we've been going pretty long.
I know, I'm running out of eloquence, what little there was to begin with tonight.
I reread the Iliad and the Odyssey, so those are honorable mentions for rereads. Those were great. Honorable mention, King Arthur, Hero and Legend, which is sort of like the history of the tales. And Canon Revisited, Establishing the Origins and Authority of the New Testament Books. We'll do a podcast. I'll be doing a podcast at some point about that one.
Okay. So. Most of what I reread last year was some Pratchett, and then I read all of the Redwall books. Whoa. And I'm going to do a podcast about that sometime this year with your brother, Zach. And that'd then I fun. Also reread The Anubis Gates by Tim Powers. And man, that is just so, so good.
Maybe this is the year.
Just really holds up so well.
It's so fun. Maybe this is the year you pick up another Tim Powers. I'm rereading some for my reread year. I'm rereading books this year. That's what I'm doing this year.
Ooh, and to say nothing of The Dog. I reread that this year, too. That's another super fun book.
I have that one on my shelf. I do want to get to that one, too.
Dad is Fat by Jim Gaffigan. I just went mostly for some easy, fun stuff. So. All right.
Yeah. When you're having a baby, you want.
But I did not reread Wheel of Time this year.
That's crazy.
First baby in a while.
First baby ever?
Boy, I don't know. It's quite possible. Melissa Kozer.
Brian Kozer.
Listening to 10 to 1.
I think my least favorite book from last year was Soul Music.
Hey, I reread that one last year, too.
Yeah, I like Terry Pratchett. I read a couple last year that just kind of trudged through and thought maybe I might be done with my Discworld reread project, but I'll keep going.
I thought Soul Music was better on my second read through. So back to Wheel of Time, though. Yeah. I remember reading the Wheel of Time for 3 out of our 5 children. I don't know if I did it with Lydia, but I know that with Amber, Penny, and Susie, every 2 years, I would go back and reread all of those books. I didn't do it with Verity.
Wow.
Yeah. Don't worry, I'll get back to them at some point.